I can't actually run through all of this, so I think I actually just need you to introduce yourself to people and explain exactly what it is you do. But I did sort of pick up the piece of paper which says that you are the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the School of Geography and the Environment.
Yeah.
And I think that you now need to explain to people what that actually means. But over to you, Danny.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. I've got to hold this mic very near for it to work. I was a bit worried when you said you'd look me up on the internet because about a year ago my younger brother phoned me saying, you need to look at this now. And if you googled Danny Dorling and you clicked images, you found a naked man standing. I had to explain to my brother that this was another Danny Dorling because I am slightly larger than the naked one. So that isn't me, if you look that up. What is the Halford Mackinder Professor? Halford Mackinder was in Oxford just over a century ago. He was a very troubled man. He was the man who started the geography department at the university. He also started the whole University of Reading. He helped start the LSE. And he was also a Conservative and Unionist MP.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah. Some American Republicans donated some money to the university in the 1970s to establish a chair in his name. So it's very enjoyable spending the money that Republicans donated to celebrate Halford. The reason they wanted to celebrate Halford is he had a theory called the Heartland Theory, which says that you have to control the centre of Europe if you're going to control the walled island, if you're going to control the world. And this theory became the basis of foreign policy for the United States of America and almost resulted in annihilation of the planet. So it's not a very, you know, happy story. I'm going to try and make this a little bit happier because talking about housing in Oxford can be tricky. And I'm going to try and goad you a little bit in the next 20 minutes for asking questions later about what we might do. I started worrying about housing 44 years ago in this city. We just moved from Cowley, from next to Cowley Centre, to Risinghurst, which was a different Risinghurst to it is now. Risinghurst then was actually the cheapest private estate. It was the first estate you could afford to buy on if you're coming off a council estate. Oxford was much more segregated then in that kind of way, because it's before the right to buy. And I got on my little bike at the age of 6 and headed out and began to map the city to see what it was like where I was, because I didn't know where I'd arrived. That's why I'm a geographer. And back then people were complaining about housing, but in a very, very different way, because North Oxford cost £1,000 more than Risinghurst, which is why my parents moved to Risinghurst, because you wouldn't spend that money on North Oxford. And people were worrying then that the only way you could actually get a council house was you had to have a baby. And people were saying, oh, don't be so nasty and don't say that. Now if you have a baby, you can be housed in Birmingham. So you know it's got much, much worse. And back then, this is back in the 1980s, a little bit later, I can remember thinking when I was about my daughter's age, the problem of the city really was just the university. And if we could get rid of the university, that would solve a lot of things. Now, the reason I thought that the university was a problem was because all I actually saw of the university as a teenager were very badly behaved, drunken, snobby, yobbish men, largely wearing weird clothes. Now, the normal students didn't wear the weird clothes, but you didn't know they were normal because they were normal. And this was a time, there was a couple, Dave and Boris, about the time, who were wrecking restaurants and all that kind of thing going on. And I had a revolutionary theory when I was 16, 17, that you would take the colleges and you would give each of them to a trade union and they could become their headquarters, or you could turn them into old age people's homes and do something better with them. And was there exactly, it took me some time to realise, in fact, those buildings are completely useless apart from putting relatively fit young 18, 19 year olds in them, because you couldn't legally house anybody in those places. the reason for saying that, or the reason for that warm-up about the university, is if you look at Oxford now, Oxford in a sense has two production lines, two large production lines. One is the production line in Cowley, which is still producing a mini, well, faster. Every 1 minute, 2 seconds, a mini comes off the line in Cowley. But it no longer requires up to near to 40,000 people. It now requires about 3,000 people. The second production line in Oxford are the universities, and in particular, postgraduate students. And a postgraduate student is worth roughly the same as a mini. If you look at the fees, the rent they pay, the multiplier effect of them being in the local community, you're essentially producing a mini a time. But with more people involved, and the postgraduate student takes up more space than a mini car on a production line. Now, you may say, oh, we could solve the problems of Oxford if we just control the two universities. If we stop them trying to expand, if we sort that one out. But they are relatively small, and it wouldn't be that easy, and it is lucrative. I used to work for 10 years in the University of Sheffield, and in Sheffield we worked out that our overseas students actually brought in, I think it's £250,000 a year to the local economy. This was the overseas students, so this counts as export earning. £250,000 a year was bigger than the entire metal industry of South Yorkshire. What the metal industry of South Yorkshire is a euphemism for the arms trade. That is basically what South Yorkshire was doing at the time. So we can argue later about controlling the universities or the growth of the university and what you do, and what's changing in the local plan about numbers of postgraduates. But essentially we have two production lines in the city. The other thing we have are hospitals. And the demand for hospitals is not going to reduce. The better our health gets, the more we're actually going to need the hospitals, because the longer we're going to live, and I'm afraid the bad news is, the longer you live, the more bits of you stop working, and you need it to be sorted out. And these hospitals are at the centre of a county that desperately needs the hospitals. Oxford is artificially small. For the largest city between London and Birmingham, it has been constrained. The handout, I wasn't allowed to do slides, you'd be glad to know. The reason for the handout was to show you a few pictures. The first, the big one, is the 1927 plan. Now, other countries still plan their cities. It's really quite a good idea to plan a city. It does make sense to do it. One thing I'd argue for is to think about, even if a plan doesn't have any statutory force, actually thinking what you want the city to be like in 30 years' time might be worth doing. It's done elsewhere in Europe. That's why their cities look relatively neat. It's why the transport flows. If you look at Grenoble, look at Bonn, look at the twin cities of Oxford, you'll see that it works. So my suggestion is there really should be a plan, and the plan should be what you want Oxford to be like next 10 years, 10 years after that, 10 years after that. The 1927 plan is circular. It's almost a bit too circular. You never get a city that circular. The reason it's circular is that the main form of transport in 1927 was the bicycle. And the thing about bikes is that you don't want to cycle that far. Young fit men like Mark over here, who I don't know how many, 15 years you've been cycling from Killington into Oxford, yes? Even in the cold today, but in general, it's too far from Killington into Oxford. You want a city that's compact if you're going to rely on the bike and on walking to get people around. And there, you can see there are things that are wrong with the 1927 plan. They didn't realise how much the rivers flooded. So those green areas are what they thought the flood risk area was, which is quite cute. when you now know what happened. But on that plan, the lower slopes of Oxford were not sacrosanct. Hinksey Heights Golf Course was not sacrosanct. Maybe Whiteham Woods is worth, Whiteham Woods is probably worth saving, I'll give it that. But there were woods further south which are just scrubland owned by St John's. And that's the best plan I've still seen for where the expansion of Oxford should be. But the second thing to say is that if Oxford is going to expand, it needs to expand very densely, because the city is basically missing about 75,000 people. We know this in many, many ways. You can look at the ONS predictions for the county. They're much less than what the LEP says is needed. But ONS say it's going to rise. We know that at peak times there are 40,000 people driving across the Greenbelt. It's possibly, per capita, the least green belt of any green belt in the world, in terms of the carbon pollution that's caused by the fact that people cannot live in a city in which they work, so they have to live outside and come in. I would suggest that you want to say that Oxford should be a city that's about 75,000 people, possibly 25,000 dwellings larger in the next 30 years, but most of those dwellings should be very, very near the centre of the city. So you're really talking about Barton Park. Lots more versions of Barton Park, but not Barton Park prices. That's the mistake. How do you get Barton Park without Barton Park prices? You have to have a change in national government. The good news is... Yay! But also you have to know what you want when you get a change in national government. The city doesn't know what it wants when it gets a change in national government. It's not going to get it. Because for so many decades, we've just got used to the idea that you can't plan. You have to go with whatever the developers want. If there isn't a developer, you can't actually have it. The developers are swarming around Oxford right now. Absolutely swarming. Colleges which have held on to land for hundreds of years are suddenly wanting to sell their land now. Right now, quickly. Some of the plans I've seen, the plans for just north of Marston. Just north of Marston, this is within 100 metres, maybe 190 metres of the John Radcliffe. And the John Radcliffe may have a need for people to work in it. I don't probably have to tell you about this. So what are you going to build just north of John Radcliffe? Big five-bedroom detached houses with double garages. That's what they'd like. They probably won't be allowed, because it's not in the gift of this city council, because it's South Oxfordshire. Who would want to live in a five-bedroom house with two garages just north of the John Radcliffe? Somebody's going to get onto the road and drive straight on the M40 into London. This is the danger. The great danger is that what happens in the next 10 years, this city, is it is ringed by executive housing with some token, you know, originally promising 40%, knock it right down to 10% social housing. Because your cleaner's got to live somewhere. That is my great fear. I think what is worth doing is, if there are schemes proposed which look anything like that, oppose them. If you're a councillor, you can't oppose them, because you may be sitting on a board where you have to use your wisdom and judgment and just don't listen to me. It's all about legal things. But if you're not a councillor, and I'm not a Labour Party member, so this is not a conspiracy of Labour, so I can say it, then unless you're looking at good quality apartments, almost all for social rent, without many car parking spaces, then say no. And the interesting thing is, there'll be other people saying no. There are lots of people who like saying no in Oxford. There is the Preservation Trust, which I never really liked until now. And then I suddenly thought, actually, the Oxford Preservation Trust is really useful, because if you need to stop people building housing that's going to make the city worse, they'll help. The CPRE. Council for Protection of Rural England, whose origins are in fascism in the 1930s. That's where CPRE comes from. But again, they don't want any of this building, so work with them. There are the Greens, whose policy is, if you can't house yourself in Oxford, move to Newcastle, it's good for Newcastle. And that obviously doesn't work. So we do need housing, but not the kind of housing that's currently being offered. What happens upon the election of a Labour government? A Labour government will, and the Shadow Housing Minister has said this, and he was a Blairite, he's hardly radical, John Healey, has said the compulsory purchase at agricultural price an agricultural price is kind of funny because it's slightly even more insulting than zero. The compulsory purchase of agricultural price of land around the cities with highest housing needs will be a policy of the next Labour government. Yeah. And then you've got to think very, very carefully about what you build and how you build it. There's all kinds of legislation out there. You could, for instance, look at what is probably Britain's most successful housing scheme. The most successful housing scheme is not very far away. It's called Milton Keynes. And you could look at how Milton Keynes did it. Not the same kind of housing in Milton Keynes, the same legislation that was used to make that housing possible. These are all the kinds of things that I think matter now. My temptation, you may call me utopian, you may just say, oh, any housing's worth it, or if the developer's half decent, let's go for it. But I would be in favour of opposition to the building of housing that will not be for people from 90-95% of Oxford society. I'll just say no. And don't worry if the housing is outside of the city boundaries that's being proposed. If you help groups who say this isn't good enough, wait until you've got a national government who actually understands the issue, and then help and present them with a plan of what you want the city to be. I think I've got about 5 minutes. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. There are loads and loads of other things you need to work out if you're thinking 30 years ahead. You may think this is silly, but 30 years ago, we had cars going through coal markets, and then we got rid of the cars, and then we had buses and bus wars, and then we got rid of the buses, and now we still have too many buses going around Carfax. You know, doing it by trial and error is just bad. It's a continued kind of mess of schemes. You need to think, a city which has 75,000 more people than Oxford currently has, for those people to get around the city, you need fewer cars inside the city. You need to make most of the main routes one way for motorised vehicles. You need to create more lanes for bicycles. It is relatively cheap compared to the idea of building a tunnel underneath the city, these kind of silly things. You need to get the population who are cycling, who are electric bikes. You need to basically double it, up from I think about 11% to 20%. You need to have more people walking. You need to make it very, very hard to park in the city. You need your carbon-free zone to be wider than it currently is. You also need to plan for more tourists, because they're going to come. No, well, it doesn't matter. Whatever you think of them, they are going to come, because the world's middle class is doubling and doubling again. And after you've been to London and Paris and New York, where do you go next? And they're going to come to Oxford. They're going to come to Oxford. Make space for them, get the cars out, and spread them out. Don't have them all trying to get into Christchurch. Every college can have a wizard. Right? Don't come early and sort it out. We all have a wizard. Open up the colleges, serve them green teas, make a fortune out of them, and then we don't have to rely on dodgy Russians for donations so we can fix the roofs. That's just where I work. But a 30-year plan has the plan for the tourists who will want to come and see. Short of actually demolishing some of the oldest buildings in the country, you can't stop them coming, but you can make it a much more pleasant experience to live here with the tourists here and work out how to get the money. Part of the reason for mentioning tourists is that after Brexit, no matter what form Brexit takes, even if she cancels Article 50, which you can do up until 10 o'clock on the 29th of March, tourism is going to be one way we're going to survive the next 10 years, because our banks are heading downwards. The EU currently isn't negotiating much about passporting for our banks. You may not have noticed that. If you don't have the money, the income from the banks, you need income from somewhere else. So the country will be looking at getting more tourists. I'm afraid they'll be looking at this city. I'm just trying to goad you with things that will make you want to ask questions. You've got to have a sense of what kind of a city you want. I'll leave you with one last issue about Oxford that needs sorting out. I've been away, I left when I was 18, and I came back when I was 45. And it makes you see things that are wrong in the city. I mean, coming back and finding a ring road as a traffic jam, when you left it wasn't, is a shock. The other thing is, coming back and finding a school system so incredibly divided. It was much less divided when I was growing up, partly because I was growing up and they just made all the grammars and secondary moderns comprehensive, and Charwell had been a secondary modern, and so the middle class were a bit unsure about sending their kids to Charwell, and so you went to the nearest school in most cases. What we now have in Oxford is this incredible house price ranking that goes up by school catchment areas. We have most of the babies being born down in the southeast of the city, and people desperately moving their families upwards to try to get into catchment areas of Cheyne and Charwell and Matthew Arnold. Oxford may possibly have the most divided education system of any European city. As I mentioned, the further the children go private. I'm doing a talk in Cheyne School on Valentine's Day, and we're trying to work out how to get the young ladies from Headington on the Hill to walk across the road, walk another 40 metres and walk into the hall. Because we need our children to start seeing each other, even if they're not going to talk to each other. Well, you pay your money so they don't mix. Why am I mentioning this to do with housing? We're just at the point of approving the first, in the most bizarre way, it has to be said, you know, because it has to be a free school. The first new secondary school in Oxford, since the one which was, the planning was agreed, I think, in the 1950s. We're going to have more. And people don't even think about that. You're going to have more. But luckily, my college, which is St Peter's, has some fields down in Botley, which are bigger than the Charwell site, just south of Botley, near Hinksey, which would work. So there's another secondary school for you, within the ring road. But also, you want a system whereby parents are not so incredibly worried about where their children are going to school. And they are at the moment. So you need to be able to move teachers between the schools, and you need to be able to move pupils between the schools. How are you going to get rid of the dominance of the private schools in Oxford? You make the state schools better. The Labour government promises to do that. But part of making the state schools better is that one state school will probably teach many languages. And if you want to do that language at A-level, you'll have to go to that school. Another school will probably become the main science site with the labs. But if you want to do physics A-level, you might have to go to that school. If you're wanting to move children around Oxford, you need to make Oxford safe enough for children to move. It's not very far. It's relatively easy for a child to move 2.5 miles, but not through the current death traps that we have at the moment if you try cycling. So a policy for housing is also a policy for transport, it's also a policy for education, it's a plan. We stopped planning in the 1980s. Planning was a dirty word. Planning was kicked out. We still have planners. But the idea of actually thinking what kind of a city and kind of a society went was kicked out. We don't know that this is what it happens in other countries. It is normal to plan. It is normal to say what you want. Two other maps on there, an extension. Mark produced a map for Oxford City Council, which is at the bottom. It shows Oxford growing, that's how a city grows, until bang, it hits the artificial boundary of the city in the Greenbelt. The Greenbelt was partly brought in the shape it is, because the colleges really didn't want this becoming an industrial city. That's why we have the tightest Greenbelt of any city. And the other little plan there is my fantasy map of cycle routes. Because we have one of the highest densities of people cycling, but there's nowhere safe to cycle out of the city. And that's where I suggest, instead of building a six-lane motorway, the outer M25, the first quarter of the outer M25, it's called the expressway. But if you can all start just calling it the outer M25, it's much... If you have a look at a map of Beijing, you can see what the plan is, from Oxford to Cambridge. Instead of spending the money building an outer M25, why not just spend 1% of the money on building some nice paved cycle routes out to the countryside? This might sound ridiculous, but I told you earlier I lived in Sheffield before I came back to Oxford for 10 years. And in Sheffield we have beautiful paved cycle routes going right across the Beacon Street. They basically covered up old railway lines with concrete. Car free, and you can cycle out. Here, where is the countryside? What the hell's happened to it? Who owns it? Why are there 2,000 lakes that you can't get to? Where is the national park? There's nowhere. You can go back to Christmas Common, which I went to as a child, and you can see it's worn smooth by the feet of people going out for a walk at the weekend because there's nowhere to go. Those cycle routes out into the countryside are a suggestion of the kind of thing you build when you've got a city which has enough housing for people that they don't have to live miles out and commute in. They can live in and on the edge of the city. Then if you want to at the weekend, you can cycle out into the countryside. And you protect the countryside either side of the cycle route. And for people who are particularly fit, they can cycle all the way in for a long distance. The model for this is Freiburg or Copenhagen. These kinds of things are normal on the continent. We've got ourselves into such an amazing mess in this country. We're the only country in Europe where life expectancy is falling. It's been falling since 2014. We're the only country in Europe where infant mortality is now rising, with no sign of a slowdown. Figures came out again last week. We're the country with the greatest economic inequality. We have the worst absolute poverty in Northwest Europe. And all of this has kind of knocked out of us the idea that you can actually plan a better future and a relatively cheap better future. The alternative is that Oxford becomes the quaint, nice, semi-rural borough of London that you live in if you don't like Hampstead. That is the alternative. There isn't a middle way between the two. You either plan for a city, which is a city which looks after the people in the city, and you tell London that London can largely house its own people because it really does have enough space, or you go for this kind of dystopian future, where the Dragon School is one of the major draws, and that's why you want to be here. You want your girls to head into Oxford Girls up there. You want to be able to park your children's large cars as well as your large cars. And Oxford's a nice place to live. When I came back, the university housed us in a university house. Because I've got 3 kids, they only offered us 1 house. Which is on Winchester Road, which is one of the poshest roads in Oxford. And it was interesting to stay there for a bit. But the most interesting and slightly enjoyable thing was that the university evicted the former tenant of this house so that we could actually live there, because they rented it out privately. Now, you may be feeling sad about this, particularly given your story. Don't feel sad. The tenant they evicted owned a bank in the Cayman Islands. And I know he owned a bank in the Cayman Islands. He owned several banks because quite lots of law enforcement letters came through our letterbox. He wasn't a very legal bank. But why on Winchester Road was there a Cayman Island banker and his family? The reason he was here, he could live anywhere in the world and he had houses all around the world. The reason he was here was for the Dragon School. The future of Oxford, if you don't control it, is more people like that. And they will create work for all the people who will decorate their houses and will clean their houses and will walk their children back and forth to school because they'll be too busy for that. There'll be lots of jobs for servants again, but it isn't the kind of city you would necessarily want to live in. I hope I've riled you up enough. The food is coming. Please give us some questions to ask. Thank you.